Well, welcome to another episode of Off the Chain with Dave and Steele. Well, Dave, how are you?
I'm doing great. I'm having a good day, and I'm excited because we have our buddy Spencer's here with us today.
I'm here.
Hey, great haircut. Let me compliment you on it a lot.
That's looking like Paul Walker.
Oh, yeah.
Guess what movie I saw yesterday?
No, you didn't, did you?
I did. I did, Dave. I saw Furious 7.
Spence, under what circumstances did you go see Furious 7? I just don't understand how that would occur in your life.
How could that not occur in my life, Dave? That's really the question you should be asking. But my wife and kids are out of town, and so I had some time yesterday evening and decided, you know, I couldn't rightfully be Dave's friend if I had never seen any movies in the series. So I had to rectify that.
This is why the show works well, because I'm clearly not Dave's friend. I've never seen any of them. Spencer, this was your chance. You should have called me. I got to see this. It's research for the show.
Steele, I tried to call you to see if you wanted to come, but you didn't answer, so you were probably off doing something else.
Oh, bummer. I was probably putting cedar down.
Oh, man. Bummer. Kids getting in the way of, like, real, real joy, you know?
I hadn't seen any of the other movies. I felt like you didn't need to see the other movies.
No, you're not missing out on plot points, really.
Yeah. I don't tend to be an action movie type person, and so I'm not the demographic they're going for, I guess. But, yeah, it gets a positive review for what it's worth. Hey, it was a fun, like, spring afternoon movie that my wife and kids are out of town, so I didn't have anything else to do.
Wait, so Spence, you went by yourself? Was there, like, a popcorn soda involved?
No, I went by myself, but no popcorn or soda. But I did sit next to a guy that was eating candy the whole time and chortling at, like, all of the funny things in the movie. And he never actually, like, yelled for any, like, good things. But if Dave were here standing and cheering, I would have stood with him and cheered.
One thing that you're probably surprised to see is how comedic Tyrese is. That guy is just an amazing comedian. I laughed at every single line he said. It didn't matter what he said. I laughed.
Yeah, he was pretty effective comic relief. And there were people weeping at the end.
Yeah. If you had a heart and you're an American, you were weeping at the end.
I am missing out on one of those categories, apparently.
So, Spencer, how packed was the theater on the day that you went to see it?
It was actually pretty full. It was probably two-thirds to three-quarters of the way full. The people weeping, most of them were women.
So or real men. They could have just been real men, Spencer.
That's true. That's true. I think the best moment, flexing his bicep and breaking his cast. That's and then he says, Daddy's got to go to work.
The bus scene is super high quality. The driving the car in between skyscrapers, Spence, this is the first time we've ever seen it. And it was...
Yeah, that was pretty awesome.
But and the other scene that's fantastic, Spence, is when Vin Diesel takes down a whole parking garage with his foot.
Yeah. And the best line from that was, he says, funny thing about street fights, the street always wins.
I've told that line to like 20 people. No one understands it, but everyone thinks it's awesome.
It is awesome.
And we saw the movie at like a place with like these recliner chairs. And after a while, I couldn't be reclined anymore. I was too worked up. I had to sit the chair back up because I just couldn't lay back and watch it.
No, you know, another part, Dave, this was all the bus part. That was like the coolest part, I think. When Paul Walker is fighting that guy in the bus that's inexplicably continues going even after everybody in the bus has been killed except the driver. The driver just keeps going. But Paul Walker takes, like, the bad guys are driving up to the side of the bus and they're about to cause problems. And he's, like, fighting the bad guy. And then he reaches up. I can't remember exactly what he does. But he, like, slams the guy's head onto the button that shoots the guns on the side of the bus.
Yes.
Remember that? And the cars get, like, totally blown away by their own leader that got his head slammed into the button.
Paul Walker, he's lots of ingenuity. And Spence, I had the same thought, like, why doesn't anybody stop? And I actually said it to Ariane, my wife. I was like, why didn't they just stop? And she's like, are you kidding? And she went on to explain to me, like, why you wouldn't stop. First of all, the bus driver, he's going to have instructions not to stop. He's carrying the very important passenger. He can't stop for anything. Two, you don't stop anytime you're in a street road fight. You can't stop. If you stop, they're going to go and get you. Your speed is your number one asset.
That's true.
So, yeah, if you have more questions about the flaws and logic in it, my wife can walk you through the whole thing.
Okay. Well, the bus scene had another curious piece, which is the bus was, let's say, at tops, was traveling like 80 to 100 miles an hour down this mountainside and then gets flipped on its side, but somehow it skids on its side for what looks to be at least a quarter to a half a mile in order to reach the edge of the cliff.
Mm-hmm.
Very low friction.
A lot of physics, or was there something special going on there that I just don't understand?
It was a greased bus.
Yeah, the grease truck had come by earlier.
It has to look good for the camera. It rubs itself down in coconut oil.
The thing that you need to remember about any Fast and Furious film, which you've never seen one before, so you don't understand, is these characters live their lives a quarter mile at a time. That's one of Vin Diesel's famous speeches. I live my life a quarter mile at a time. So you just have to know in a Fast and Furious movie, if a bus needs to get somewhere, it's going to get there. Like, it doesn't matter what physics say. The bus is going to get there.
Yeah. Oh, you know, another part that was awesome, they've got the hacker person, and they're trying to, like, play keep away with the bad guys. Mm-hmm. And at one point, they need to switch cars. They need her to be in a different car, but they, you know, they can't pull over. There's no way you can stop, like you said. So what do? They set it up so they're coming head-on at each other, and then they crank the wheels at an angle at the last second and, like, turn around, skid around side by side. It's like they're dancing for just a moment, enough for her to jump out one window and into the other, and then they continue on their way because they've done a full 360.
It's amazing. What's really interesting about all these stunts, Spence, is that there were no stunt drivers. It was just Paul Walker's just like, hey, I got an idea for this. Let's try it out. They actually did it on one take.
Really?
Yeah.
No. Yeah, I just figured it was probably mostly computers doing the work anyway.
That's ignorant, Spence. Yeah. These guys can drive.
That's why I didn't enjoy the movie as much as I could have. I'm ignorant.
I agree.
You're really into robots, Spence. So if robots were driving these cars, wouldn't that have made it more exciting?
Yeah, but that might have taken some of the emotion out of the movie, Steele. I haven't seen the other ones, but my guess is this was probably the most emotional of them all.
Vin Diesel has said so himself. We talked about it the other week. He feels like this is going to win the Best Picture Award, and I agree. Tell me one movie that is going to be better than this year. There's not going to be a movie better than that.
Are they going to make a sequel to the Paddington movie that came out last year? That could maybe win.
No, but one of the previews was for a movie about a teddy bear that talks and gets married.
Got some tight competition.
Yeah, I don't remember what it's called, but it looked like I probably would not go see it.
Did it have Mark Wahlberg in it?
Yes, it did.
Yeah, that's a sequel. So it's not Paddington 2, but it's like Ted 2. Or Ted 2, yeah.
Yeah, well, you don't want to underestimate Mark Wahlberg's comedic chops, Spence. That guy, he can hit a line, and he just nails it.
Yeah, I wasn't so much concerned about him, but the bear. Because that's computer-driven. Robots just aren't as funny.
So I could talk about Furious 7 for another 45 minutes, but should we just go ahead and start our episode here?
All right, so we got a little Furious 7, a teaser taster. We're going to have probably several episodes down the road dedicated to this film. We'll have more of Dave's friends who've actually seen the film come on and talk about it.
But still, there's still a chance. It's still in theaters, man. And you can just rent or Netflix or whatever, any of the other six movies, and you're good to go.
All right, maybe I'll do it. It's one of my goals. But today we are talking all episode about Sparts.
Wait, pardon me, Steele? What was that?
Sparts.
Sparts
ball.
Oh, yeah.
That was my Utah accent, Dave. You didn't recognize it?
No, my wife's grandfather speaks like that, actually. Harses, Sparts, Karn.
Yeah. Yeah. Today is the day that we talk about Sparts. Sparts from beginning to end. We're going to talk about the NBA, some bests in the NBA, video games, fashion, names. We're going to talk about friendships and rivalries in the Sparts world. We got a small talk, the sport. Dave's going to introduce us to that. We got Unchained Melodies, and we've got some book wisdom. But it's just sports ball, all the way down. First thing I wanted to start with, though, guys. In 1993, I was 11 years old. I collected lots and lots of sports cards. Was that a common element in either of your lives?
Yeah, I was exclusively baseball.
Yeah, I was mostly just baseball, football, basketball here or there, but a lot of baseball. I always wanted the pack that came with some gum. Yeah, that was my primary focus was, like, I want the baseball cards, but you need to give me a little something extra. And so it was Tops, yeah.
I'm surprised that sugar had anything to do with your decision-making, Dave.
Yeah, Spence, at 11 to 12, 13, that was the only decision-making driver that I had.
So when I was 11, I branched out into basketball cards, and I got a whole bunch of them. And one of the things I decided to do, because I was a normal, you know, well-adjusted 11-year-old, I decided that I was going to go through my entire basketball card collection that year and make a detailed spreadsheet with the kinds of sneakers that every player wore. So I made a list. It's got over 200 players on it and includes the type of shoes that I could determine that they were wearing in the basketball cards that I had. So I wanted to give you guys a little quiz to see what you knew about 1993 NBA shoe fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think either of you could name the top three sneaker brands in 1993 NBA basketball cards?
I think I could do it, Steele, yeah.
Yeah, I think I could probably do it.
Okay, what do you think's number one?
It's got to be Nike.
I agree. It's got to be Nike.
And by how much of a margin would you say?
I think it's pretty significant, although in 1993, I believe Reebok was hitting pretty hard with the pump. So I think, yeah, of 200, I'd say 120 Nike, something like that.
Wow, you guys are good. So Nike came in first with 99 total players, 94 of which only wore Nikes. I had five players that were wearing or more than one brand in different photographs. Reebok, as you said, Dave, was second with 39. So, I mean, it had a pretty significant lead. And here's where it gets tricky. Number three.
So I think there's a chance we could have Converse here. I feel like they were pretty big at that time. I don't think we're going to have like Adidas. Right now, Under Armour's making a push, but they didn't even exist back then. And what do you think, Spence?
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think it's Adidas. I don't even know if they really made basketball shoes at that point. So maybe Converse.
You guys are good. Converse was third. There were 18 that only wore Converse, 17 that only wore Adidas. Some of the more prominent players who were sporting Adidas back in those days, James Worthy, Nick Van Exel, Detlef Schrempf, and Mitch Richmond.
Of course,
I mean, they had some big names.
They had a foothold. Is there
a foothold. I like it.
What I believe I remember is Karl Malone wore Converse, and I don't know if either of you guys remember that Converse for a short time had these ones called like catapults. Do you remember those?
I do, Dave, but those were not Converse.
Those weren't Converse?
No, man. Karl Malone was one of three players in the NBA to wear LA Gears.
Whoa!
Wow. No, I guess I should have known that. One time we were on a camp out, a church camp out, and we were close to a river, the Snake River, and a group of kids had run down to the river to like play around or whatever, and who should be pulling his boat out of the river onto his big, you know, hauled by his big truck, but Karl Malone himself. So all these kids come running back to camp, and they're like, hey, Karl Malone's at the river, and everybody's like, oh, shut up, you're stupid. And then everybody's like, no, really? And so then people start thinking, oh, they're really serious about this. So we start to run over. And then, yeah, sure enough, there he was. And he gave away his shoes. And I'm trying to remember the name of the guy who was with him. There was kind of like a minor player on the Jazz who was huge. But I got his shoe, one of his shoes. It was a size 18 or something ridiculous. I don't remember how big it was, but it was gigantic.
Was it Mark Eaton?
No, it was another black guy.
Thurl Bailey?
No, yeah. it was not Thurl.
Oh, no.
Antoine Carr?
Oh, maybe it was Antoine Carr. No, I don't think it was Antoine Carr either. This is going to nag me forever because I should remember this.
Felton Spencer?
No.
Well, what I really want to know, what brand was the shoe that you got?
So I should remember this too. I don't know if we still even have the shoe. I seem to remember it was Reebok.
Reebok.
I'll have to see if my parents still have it at their house.
Guess it's one of a million. Reeboks. Ridiculous. It could have been Felt and Spencer. He wore Reeboks according to my spreadsheet. They're old and Polonies.
Yeah, it wasn't either of them.
Okay, so the thing that was real exciting to me about this spreadsheet was looking at the kind of heterogeneity. There were tons of brands. There were a total of 17 different shoe brands that were worn in the NBA in 1993. I think that's way more than exists today.
It's basically
Nike, yeah. Adidas, maybe some Reeboks, maybe some Under Armour. But here are some of the lesser known brands. There was one player in the NBA, Sadale Threet, wore Asics.
Asics, nice.
Nice. I didn't even know Asics made basketball shoes.
Maybe he just was wearing wrestling shoes and playing basketball.
Could be. British Knights.
Those were cool.
It was Derek Coleman.
Yeah, I thought the legend always was that those shoes were somehow like gang related.
Yeah, that's what I heard in my school too. Our very white elementary school, Spence. We knew all about gangs.
That's right.
There was one guy in the NBA who wore Ewings. Any idea who that was?
Is that Patrick Ewing himself?
It was indeed. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the Ewing Shoe Company is still alive. I went to their website. I guess they're still selling shoes. I've never seen them in the real world, but they exist.
Oh, I'm pretty sure Kevin Durant wears them.
What? So there was one guy who wore Spalding's, which is awesome because those are the shoes my grandpa wears. But the guy was Akeem Olajuwon, so I guess they worked out. And one dude who wore New Balances.
Oh, man.
Those are nice shoes, New Balance.
Who wore the New Balances?
Ty Corbin.
Oh.
Didn't he play for the Kings?
Yeah, he did. And then he was the Jazz head coach just recently.
Yeah, he was just recently fired from two different head coaching jobs.
Yeah, blame it on the New Balance.
I would. If he was wearing Nikes, he wouldn't have to be dealing with that.
And Spud Webb wore Mizuno's, which is awesome.
Oh, yeah.
That's what Ricky Henderson wore, too. His baseball shoes were Mizuno's.
I love it. The good old days. I don't think you can get away with it now. You're going to be ostracized if you're wearing Mizuno's or LA gear.
And they had three guys who wore Fila's. Remember those? Those were awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Five guys, actually six, who wore Avia. I've never even seen those, I don't think. Clyde Drexler was the most famous. But Fred Roberts also wore them.
Any FUBU? Did we get any FUBU at that time?
No, they didn't. And no Starberries either. It was a little too early. And there were two guys who wore Champions. Vlade Divac was one of them.
Oh, what? Was he ever an NBA champion? I don't think he ever made it. I don't think they ever won it when Vlade was playing.
The Kings got robbed on that seventh game with like all those fouls called against the Lakers or against the Kings.
Maybe those shoes are cursed.
Could be. No more Champions. Anyway. So you guys did great on that quiz. You know a lot about NBA shoe brands in the mid-90s. I'm impressed.
I'm pretty confident I know a lot more about them at that time than I would now. I mean, when you're like 12 or 13, shoes, that's pretty much one of your highest priorities.
You're a big sneakerhead.
Oh, yeah. I had pumps back then.
There's a guy that Steele and I play basketball with that has pumps.
Oh, wow.
It's amazing. I didn't even know those still existed.
I remember I bought a pair of pumps and they came with like CO2 cartridges. You could like pump them up real fast. It was like a little scientific thing. It was crazy.
I remember when they first came out, I thought that the pump was to give you like extra spring. It didn't occur to me that the whole point was to like increase the lateral support. So it was like, oh, it's like having trampolines on your feet.
That's what I thought. That's what I still think. I don't know what this lateral support nonsense is about. You can jump higher with them. That's what D. Brown wore when he blindfolded himself.
Yeah, that's true.
He didn't blindfold himself.
Yeah, no, he put his arm in front of his face. He, technically, no blindfold, but it was still beautiful. Yeah.
But Cedric Ceballos did the blindfold, right?
Yeah, he did. But I think lots of people think he could see through the blindfold.
So it was a fake.
Yeah, I think it might have been a fake.
I always wish that there was an NBA player who wore like business shoes or something. Just to make a statement that the shoes you're wearing actually don't matter a whole lot.
That'd be great. Probably a good move for him financially.
Yeah.
Sponsored by Spencer. Spencer and I play basketball. I'm currently wearing Adidas. I got them from the outlet mall. But Spencer, what do you wear?
I wear Sauconies.
And nobody in the NBA was wearing Sauconies in the Earth 93.
Yeah, nobody wears them now,
trendsetter.
as far as I know.
Good lateral support or no?
I don't need lateral support steel. There's no stopping for me.
Continual motion.
That's right.
Well, let's talk more of NBA bests. I want to know first, best NBA video game, your favorites of all time?
NBA Jam, of course, was a phenomenon. I think everybody enjoyed that. But I was a big fan of NBA Live, probably like 94, 95. I would play a lot of that, oftentimes by myself.
So I would watch Steel play a lot of that at like 2:30 in the morning when we were infants.
The best part of that, Spence, was I rarely actually played the game. I was doing the general manager mode, just doing simulations. That's how awesome I was.
And then you'd wake me up in the middle of the night and be like, hey, I made these big trades, and look, man, I just won the championship. But you hadn't actually done anything except switch players.
No, just simulated it. Yeah. Yep.
So is that your top game, NBA Live, from the 90s?
I don't know. See, here's the thing. In 1995, that was the first NBA Live franchise I bought for my PC. Went out and spent $50 on it. I was so excited to come home and play it. And the problem was, I went to install it, and I didn't have enough RAM on my computer. I didn't know what RAM was. So I had to go back to the store, and I had to buy RAM. I bought like 128 kilobytes of RAM or whatever, and it cost another $70. So I paid like over $100 to play NBA Live 95. So it's the most precious video game I ever bought. But I don't know if it was my favorite. The first NBA video game I ever played was Dr. J versus Larry Bird on the Commodore 64.
Mm-hmm.
That game was amazing. I loved that game.
The first game I remember, there's actually a famous song now about this, but there was a game called Double Dribble.
Double Dribble!
That was a good one. There was one that you could like shoot from three-quarters court, and you'd make it at least half the time, and so that's what I'd always do. I feel like
Double Dribble, yeah. And that was the game where the mascots would come out and dance at halftime, and if you picked the Lakers, there's a bunch of like lakes that ran out with legs and would dance around on the court and then run off the court. That was great.
Yeah. I have not played an NBA video game in probably like a decade, but I have a lot of really positive memories of doing it.
Oh, me too. So, Dave, when you played NBA Jam, who was your team? Who was your duo?
I can't remember. I feel like I wanted Chris Webber most of the time. I liked that he was tall and bald, so I was way into Webber.
I'm surprised you weren't into Brad Lojas, Milwaukee Bucks. Wasn't it him and Blue Edwards? That was like the worst team in the game.
I don't think anyone ever picked them, like ever. I don't think it happened.
Yeah, there were some Brad Lojas fans out there somewhere.
Which team, who was on the Suns?
It was Kevin Johnson and Charles Barkley, I think.
Oh, yeah. Boy.
For some reason, I think I used to choose them a lot.
I think I was a Utah Jazz fan at the time, so it was Stockton and Malone. Classic Big and Little.
Oh,
and I remember also, you could, if you put in the cheat codes, you could unlock special players. And I remember unlocking George Clinton from Parliament, like the P-Funk All-Stars. He had colorful hair. That was awesome.
And you never wanted to be the Bulls because Jordan refused to be in the game somehow. So there was no Jordan on the Bulls.
Yeah. Yeah, don't be the Bulls. Hey, well, speaking of P-Funk and great hair, this is a rich subject for us to discuss. We want to talk about the best NBA hairstyles. Because there have been some great ones. Any favorites for you guys?
My current favorite would have to be, I really like what Amon Shumpert's doing. I love the high top fade. I loved it in the 90s. I didn't like that it went away for like 20 years. And I'm so glad he's doing it right now.
Man, his hair looks great. I watched the Cavs game, just a few minutes of one the other night. He put it flying in for a putback dunk. And I was like, who is that? Oh, that's Amon Shumpert. Just right away, the hair.
It's a great marketing decision for him, too, because, like, I would not really know who he was except for the hair. Like, I know exactly what he looks like. I know who he is. I'm a huge fan. And it's based almost entirely on his haircut.
It's also one of the great names in the NBA right now. Amon Shumpert? That's pretty good.
That is solid.
I think the original haircut, the original high-top fade that I loved was Kenny Walker. Played for the Knicks. He won that dunk contest in the early 90s. He had a great high top fade. It was almost Kid and Play esque.
Yeah, whenever you can get any comparison to Kid from Kid and Play with your hairstyle, like, you're doing something correctly.
Yeah, you know, a lot of things correctly.
But the entire Knicks team in the 90s, though, Steele, that every single person had the exact same haircut. They had the high top fade, the flat top, and it was fantastic. I think they all went to the same barber.
You think that was one of Pat Riley's rules? It's like, you don't get any playing time unless you have a high top fade. I love it.
All right, guys, we do two things on this team. We play defense and we get high top fades.
Oh, man, that'd be great.
There were some good, like, white guy flat tops, too. You got, like, Greg Ostertag, Chris Mullin.
Wait, Spence, I think you misspoke. I think you said there were some good white guy flat tops. But then you mentioned Greg Ostertag.
I mean, there were existing some white guy flat tops.
Chris Mullin did have awesome hair.
I think he still has that exact same haircut. I don't think he's changed. He's 50 and he's still sporting it.
He was really good in NBA Jam.
Now that I think about it, I think that was another team that I chose often. Because Chris Mullin, he was like money from 3-point.
How about hairstyles, Spence? What's a hairstyle that knocks you out other than the white guy flat top?
Well, you gotta go with Dr. J.
Oh, one of the classic, iconic afros.
Exactly. It just doesn't get any better than that.
I really like Jerry curls, especially the big Jerry curls. Like A.C. Green's hair, I liked Michael Cage, and he kept it until like the 90s. And then J.R. Reed, he and Kendall Gill were the only guys that I remember that combined like the high top fade with the Jerry curl, and that's brave.
It's groundbreaking, but I don't think we can talk about afros nearly enough. If there's one hairstyle I wish that I could have, which I'll never have, it would be the afro. I 100% support it anytime someone does it in this day and age. I just think it's cool.
Especially if you're a super tall guy. Because it makes you look another 4 inches taller. Like Artis Gilmore, I think he was already 7'3 or something like that. But he grew a big afro, had huge sideburns, and he probably looked like he was 10 feet tall to people of his era.
Yeah, there's got to be some like psychological advantage there.
Yeah, Ben Wallace's, I think his whole career, he was never a very talented offensive player, but he grew a crazy looking afro, and people all of a sudden started giving him money and playing time.
Ben Wallace also wore those like armbands above his muscles or whatever. That guy looked like a warrior. He was awesome. When I was in high school, I made this big book, poetry and other things, for my sophomore year English class. And I also included tons of photographs of historic NBA players with afros. And I dedicated the book to them. And my favorite one, NBA history, was a guy named Darnell Hillman. You guys need to Google this guy if you don't know him. He was an ABA player. I think he at one point was a teammate of Dr. J's, but his afro puts Dr. J's to shame. It's probably the greatest sports afro I have ever seen. He was incredible.
Wow. That's pretty amazing.
It seems like the difficulty in the afro would be just the shape. How do you maintain like such a nice, like he just maintains a really nice roundness that's very pleasing to the eye, which I think is why he has such a great afro. It seems like it'd be hard to maintain.
Yeah, because think about like somebody like Josh Childress. He sort of had an afro, but his, to me, always just looked embarrassing.
Yeah, it looked like it was a little bit off-center or something, a little bit fading back. Yeah, it looked like something had gone slightly wrong.
Like it was a little too dense or something. Moochie Norris, when he had his afro, it was a little raggedy, but he just looked worlds cooler.
There's also there's some awesome white guy hairstyles. I was a big fan of Andre Kirilenko for a little while just because I don't understand what the hairstyle he was, what he was doing, what the purpose of it was, but it's amazing. It's like an unattractive woman from the 90s. That's what he took that picture in and he's like, give me this.
It was probably somebody from Friends. He really was into Friends and he was like, hey, just give me this haircut. You know, the thing about him, Mr. Versatility, both on the court and with hairstyles. Yeah. That guy had 5 or 6 different terrible haircuts, and all of them were really, really, really memorable.
Yeah, I always wondered if maybe it was his probably, like, European soccer tradition that just kind of bled over into, because he was from Russia, right? So
Yeah, very
maybe that
much.
was just the way they do things, you know? It's like the
Give
soccer
me bad
players.
haircut. I like so much.
Because you see like lots of soccer players with mohawks and like crazy stuff. But I'm surprised that we haven't talked about Dennis Rodman.
I almost forgot about him. Yeah, I guess he colored it all crazy.
Yeah, well, yeah, the hair itself wasn't all that interesting, but he was always coloring it.
I feel like his was just kind of a sad cry for attention, and these
Really
other
was.
guys were just doing it because they love good hair, you know? I guess that's I don't want to give him the attention that he's crying for when these other guys are just they're doing it for the love of the style, you know?
Yeah, it's
True.
true.
That's
Can we talk
true.
about mullets for a second? Because last Thursday I played basketball with Spencer, and he was wearing a mullets themed t-shirt.
That's true. Probably the highest profile mulleted player is Larry Bird.
Oh yeah. That's why they call him Larry Legend,
That's
right?
right. He had the mullet and the pedophile stash.
Oh, true.
Yeah, like
Must
when I
admit.
see Bird's mustache, it makes me feel really good about mine. I'm like, whoa, I've got a real mustache compared to Larry Bird.
He's a great basketball player, and it's good that he was because the guy was just ugly. I remember, like, I think at one point I was watching a game and he dunked it, and I was like, wow, Larry Bird can dunk?
I still debate whether that actually happened, Spence. I don't know that Larry Bird could dunk.
I'm gonna have to look, see if I can find something.
I think if you want to find a good mullet NBA history, just look for a guy whose last name ends with ski. Any all those kind of Polish guys or second generation SKI guys. You had Paul Mokeski, probably the ugliest guy in NBA history, curly mullet. You had Mike Jaminski, had a mullet for a while. I mean, anybody who's a ski, they had mullets.
I'm a big fan of Paul Mokeski. That guy, he
Yeah.
does not look like an athlete whatsoever, and he's out there performing. That's great. But still, I'm gonna be honest. You emailed me a list, and I just want you to talk about the greatest NBA hairstyle of all time. I've been sitting like just waiting. I'm waiting for you to talk about it.
This guy is the NBA version of Billy Ray Cyrus. He looked just like him. He was 7'2" out of the University of Florida. So he was like a gator wrestling, cowboy boot wearing, just all around American hero. A little bit of Patrick Swayze in him. His name was Dwayne Schintzius. And he had a ferocious mullet. It was definitely business up front. And it was 110% party in the back. That guy's hair was unstoppable. Just that was his look.
It's combined with the flat top. He's got he, like if he cuts the mullet off, he's Chris Mullin. But
Yeah.
no, he's got like a foot long of hair back there. It's just an amazing choice that he moves forward with that I could never do. I
Total
salute him.
waterfall. He deserves to be saluted, definitely. The other look that I'm really partial to, guys, was the bald with beard or bald with mustache look. So it's like the bald with beard was especially good because it's like they have two beards. It's like a beard on their chin and then a beard on the top of their head, you know? Those ones were great. Nate Thurmond had a really incredible one. And the other guy I remember who had a really good balding with beard was World Be Free.
Oh man.
This was a look in the 70s.
It's a good look.
So facial hair, speaking of beards, mustaches, or unibrows, anybody have favorites on those lists?
Oh, you got to go with Fred Roberts.
I used to think that was the greatest NBA unibrow, but I'm not so sure anymore. There's a
Really?
guy whose name is the Brow.
Oh man, I can't believe it. This guy, Anthony Davis, is unbelievably talented. Like he's going to own the NBA for the next decade, and he's made the decision that I'm going to just continue to have this unibrow and look, I don't know, like terrifying. Like he wouldn't be a handsome man even if he got rid of the unibrow, but with the unibrow, he's not doing himself any favors.
What's the name of that eagle from the Muppets? The blue one? You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, yes, I do. I can't think of
He
the
looks
name.
almost exactly like Anthony Davis. So those are some classic unibrows. Mustaches or beards? Any of the best face hair?
Already talked about Mark Eaton earlier, but I, of course, support giant white men with red hair and beards. I
Yeah.
think that's wonderful. And then there's my current favorite player in the NBA. That's James Harden, and that's based entirely off of his facial hair. I was showing him to my wife last night, and she's just like, "Wow, that is terrific." He's now her favorite player too, just because of the beard.
He has such a great beard. That
Yeah.
guy's all swag.
And he's good too.
Totally. You know who used to have a great beard? Baron Davis. I think he had the NBA's best beard before James Harden.
Yeah, but Harden just owns it now. Like Baron
Yeah.
Davis's was great, but Harden just lets it go. It's just such a sweet beard. I wish I had that beard.
A lot of people probably do. That's a handsome beard. You know who the anti-James Harden beard was? Drew
No.
Gooden. Drew Gooden was an embarrassment to facial hair. That guy was one weird dude. He grew that weird, like, plug in the back of his head. It was like a, I don't know, a little patch that he just grew for like half a season, just on its own. And then he grew this nasty looking beard that he braided into like three or five pieces. He was like him and Scott Pollard were the facial hair embarrassments of the NBA.
I think he's still playing somewhere. Like every once in a while, you'll be watching a game, and all of a sudden, Drew Gooden's in. You're like, that guy still plays?
He's an ageless wonder. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention my favorite NBA mustache, James Edwards. He had a Fu Manchu that just looked awesome on him. I don't think anybody in NBA history has looked so good with the Fu Manchu.
Great job, James.
All right. So here's our last NBA obsession. And this is a big obsession. We talked about Name of the Year not too long ago. There's an annual contest with a bracket for the greatest name of the year. There's voting going on right now, so make sure you get over Name of the Year and vote. But the NBA has had some outstanding names, and we want to give a little respect to the great names of NBA history. Anybody have some favorites?
I've always been partial to Clarence Weatherspoon. I found myself cheering for him. I never understood why, but it's wholly because of the name.
I feel the same way about Charles Shackelford, actually, as well. I think he played for the Sixers as well. He was like a generation before Weatherspoon. The Shackelford to Weatherspoon baton was an important one in NBA circles.
One of my favorites is based off of NBA Live, I think in like 95. I took the Jazz. I played a whole season with them, and they had a guy on the bench named John Crotty.
Oh, yeah, John Crotty.
I made him a starter. I made him the top scorer in the league. I was obsessed with John Crotty. I was just a huge fan.
You know, I couldn't count on him in NBA games. His injury rating was really high. I found he was always like tearing his groin and stuff. But I really wanted to do the same thing. I wanted to make Crotty a star. I just couldn't do it.
Oh, I did it. He top scorer in the league. Stockton lost his starting role to
You know, I felt like him and Dan Dickow have a couple great names. One of my other favorite ones was Rory Sparrow. When I was a kid, we were living in Sacramento. And we'd go to Kings games when they were really, really bad. And the best guy on the team one year was Rory Sparrow. And we'd sit up in the nosebleeds and he'd make a basket. And the announcer would go, "Rory Sparrow!" It was awesome. That's one of my great childhood memories.
I always liked Muggsy Bogues. I loved his name, and then he was an inspiration to me because I was always like the shortest kid on the playground. And Muggsy Bogues was what, 5'6" or something like that?
No, 5'3".
5'3", and he was out there playing with the tall guys.
Yeah, him and
So,
Earl Boykins were the two shortest guys ever.
yeah, and then Spud Webb, that's another
Yeah,
good
he was
name,
short.
and he was a good player.
A great name. He
Yeah.
played for the Kings too. I also have to say, this guy was terrible, and I hated him because he went to Duke. But Cherokee Parks, isn't that a great name? It's like a thing.
That's actually, well, that's almost a complete sentence if you.
Complete sentence. Basically, every African player in the NBA has had a great name.
Just run through like five or six still, because I love them.
Yenkidare, Boniface Ndong, Ala Abdelnaby, Egypt's finest NBA export, Bismack Biyombo, Dikembe Mutombo. There was Pops Mensa Bonsu, who I loved. Ruben Bumcha Bumcha, Kalena Azubuki, and Festus Azili. Anybody named Festus? Because you know they have a nephew out there that's calling him Uncle Festus. That's cool.
This is what I want to ask you guys. If you had to change your name to one NBA name from NBA history, which one would you go with?
That's a great question.
Yeah, it's hard to divorce the name from the player, like how good the player was. Because I'd be tempted to name myself after like somebody who was awesome, but they may not have the coolest name.
No, I'm talking. You got to go coolest name. Yeah. You just pick one that's the coolest.
This one's easy for me. I would definitely become God Sham God.
Yes, that's beautiful. You could write a nice book of poetry with that name.
Yeah, God Sham God or Predrag Drobnjak. I love the name Predrag. There's been 3 or 4 Predrags in the NBA, and that's the greatest NBA first name, I think. I don't know if that's how it's pronounced, but that's how I pronounce it, Predrag.
And if it's your name, you tell people how to pronounce it, so you're okay.
How about you, Dave?
I didn't even know this name before, but Pops Mensa Bonsu.
Isn't that great?
It's so good. I could open up some type of restaurant and it'd be Pops Place. People would love me.
That guy was ebullient. Everybody loved him. Joyful guy. Energy player. He was like a fan favorite everywhere he played.
What'd you settle on, Spence?
I don't know. Like all I can think about is the names that I would pick to horrify other people. Like Stromile Swift. That just sounds like something vaguely sexual and wrong.
Yeah, but at least it happens quickly.
That's right.
What about Luigi Datomi? That seems like a Spence name.
Yeah, maybe I'd do some European name like, I don't know.
Vitali Potapenko?
Dino Raja?
That's a good one.
Dino Raja might be cool.
Geert Hamink? Those Belgians. I'm Geert.
there's one on this list, Steele. I don't know if you could pronounce it for me, because I don't know that I can. His first name is Gregor.
Oh, man. This one I was the most sad about. I think the two best names in NBA history, well, this one would have been clearly the best name in NBA history, but he never came to the NBA. There was a time in the early 90s, he was the MVP of the Italian League and was one of the best players in Europe, and he was going to come, but he didn't come over to the NBA. And his name was Gregor Fuchka, but it's spelled F-U-C-K-A. And I have been looking for at least 15 years to buy a Gregor Fuchka jersey with the F-U-C-K-A as the name on the back. That's the only sports jersey that I would own with the player's name on it. That would be hilarious. I'd wear it everywhere. And I always imagine like his mom going to games and everybody pointing to her and saying, oh, look, there's Mother Fuchka, but not pronouncing it Fuchka.
Oh, Fuchka. So you said he would be tied. So what's your number one best name ever? Have you revealed that?
Yeah, I haven't. This guy's a German. He was looked like an albino. I think he played for the Spurs, maybe for the Hawks. I don't remember. But his name was Yui Blob. Yui Blob. And he was like a 7-footer, kind of your classic stiff, kind of roly-poly guy. And that's just such a good name. Can't go wrong.
Making him albino as well. I mean, it's great. I'm glad. Yeah. I'm glad he's doing it, you know?
Yeah, we'll have to save nicknames for another time. But there's some great nicknames. We could do all sport nicknames. That'd be a fun show.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, we promised to talk about – this is a topic I think that Spencer was especially interested in because of your love of Screamin' Jay, Spencer.
That's
right.
You want
to tell the people a little about Screamin' Jay?
Screamin' Jay Hawkins. He's a musician who I think prided himself on having reproduced more children than basically anybody else on Earth.
Except Genghis Khan, maybe.
Except maybe Genghis Khan. And they've actually – I think they have – or at least at one point there was a website and somebody was trying to like unite all of these children of Screamin' Jay. And they wasn't it like 70 something kids?
I think it was larger than the population of Canada in final count.
In fact, didn't he father the nation of Canada?
I believe so. Screamin' Jay Canada. Okay, so this is something that NBA players are notable for, and I hesitate to bring up the topic because I do think it's often tinged with some strange racial stuff and some clear racism that's directed towards NBA players. But I do have to say, there are some NBA players who have had a lot of children with a lot of different women. And when I was a kid, the rumor was that Larry Bird was one of these guys. I don't know what the truth of this was, but I used to hear rumors about Larry Bird.
They got the opportunity. They're flying city to city. They're famous. They're tall. Women like tall men, from what I understand.
And they're incredible athletes playing with very small jerseys, so there's not a lot left to the imagination.
No, there's a lot of opportunity for a nice Stromile Swifting wherever they go.
Yeah. The guy that was notorious was Sean Kemp. I mean, that's the other guy you heard about, right, a lot? Seven kids.
I heard a lot about Hakeem Olajuwon, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't know if that's true, but who knows if you know, any of these are actually true.
The story that I heard that has been confirmed is the Dikembe Mutombo one. He used to go into bars, and he would yell, "Who wants to sex Mutombo?" And women would volunteer. It worked, apparently. So you can use that line with your sweetheart, listeners.
I think I'll decline on that one.
Okay. Oh, boy. That's beautiful. I think we've really stumbled into something beautiful now that we're discussing.
I'm surprised to see Scott Skiles on this list. He's not exactly a looker.
No, that was the good surprising one. And he's like an NBA coach. He's always wearing a suit. You'd think he's pretty buttoned down. But he's pretty unbuttoned from the looks of it.
Yeah.
The numbers are impressive. I hope these kids are doing okay. Good luck to all those kids out there with NBA fathers. You at least you're gonna have great genes. Those guys are powerful, athletic. It's terrific. You're gonna do okay.
Yeah, I hope so. Speaking about doing okay, we want to talk about off the chain friendships and rivalries. Dave, you contributed some strong contenders to your favorite teams or teammates.
If we're going all sports here, I lived in New Jersey in the late 90s, early 2000s. If there's one sports team that dominated that entire area during that time, it's the New York Yankees. And my greatest friendship from there, it's not Jeter and Rodriguez because they're not actually buddies anymore, but it's the core four. Derek Jeter, Mariano Rivera, Andy Pettit, and Jorge Posada. These are the core four. They won all the championships together. They're true Yankees, and it's beautiful. They did it together.
So were these guys buddies in real life?
I don't know.
I can't imagine Jorge Posada hanging out with like Andy Pettit and Mariano Rivera, but maybe.
They would go on vacations together, rent houses together. For a short time, they all just shared the same condo in New York together. Inseparable, really, is what I'd say. Even now in retirement, there's plans that they just kind of have a cul-de-sac with a house for each of them.
Really?
Beautiful friendship. No, none of that's true. But that's what I like to imagine as like a 18-year-old boy in Yankee Stadium watching the Yankees win the World Series against the Padres. I was like, man, those guys must be best friends. This is the best night of my life. And up to that point, it probably was.
I'm glad you added that caveat there, Dave.
Yeah, it's hard to comment on that because I imagine Steele feels the same, but I hate the Yankees.
It's true. They're terrible. But you don't have a lot of choice when you're raised in New Jersey.
No, and there's nowhere else to turn, guys. It wasn't a happy time in my life, to be honest. But the Yankees, they provided a little bit of brightness. And I'll always appreciate Mariano Rivera for that.
That guy was classy.
I kind of would have expected, Dave, that you would turn to the Mets.
I've probably been to like 20 to 30 Nets games. I've seen a lot of Nets games. And
Mets, Dave.
Mets? Oh, yeah. No way, Spence. If you move into New Jersey, what was it? It was like 95 when I moved there. You're not jumping on the Mets bandwagon. That's impossible. But my favorite friendship, sports friendship ever, has got to be Steve Nash and Dirk Nowitzki.
Oh, that's a cute one, Dave.
Isn't that just two large white guys with long floppy hair passing the ball to each other, hitting mid-range shots, having a great time. And even when Steve Nash leaves the Mavericks, they're still buddies. They have dinner together. It warms my heart.
You know what I bet they talked about a lot? I'm pretty sure that they were both big Knight Rider fans. I'm guessing that was the glue that held their friendship together. Because Hasselhoff is big in Germany. And I bet he's popular in Canada, too. I don't know.
No, I think he is Canadian.
Oh, there you go.
Well, again, that's something I just made up right now. So don't go with that. But, it could be possible.
Well, first, I'm wondering if he's Canadian, does that mean he's Screamin' Jay's son?
Wow, everything's connecting.
There you go.
I wish I could have unlocked Screamin' Jay on NBA Jam. That would have been awesome. Play with George Clinton and Screamin' Jay.
That's right.
How about you, Spencer? Favorite rivalries or favorite teammates?
I grew up in Idaho, and so it was kind of Utah Jazz territory. So, you know, Stockton to Malone, that's kind of a go-to dynamic duo.
I thought you were going to say Howard Eisley and Greg Ostertag.
Yeah, I mean,
talk about dynamic.
It's like that was like kind of the quintessential NBA duo. They were the masters of the pick and roll. And to hear some tell it, Stockton was the master of dirty play.
For sure.
And Malone was kind of the enforcer. He'd step in to make sure nobody messed with him.
Yeah, they were definitely dirty players, but I was just looking at their career stats. It's incredible. Those guys were two of the statistically probably the best 20 players ever. So durable, such longevity, and to be teammates for that long, and to be such different human beings by all accounts.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, and those Jazz teams have to be like among the greatest teams that never won a championship.
Oh, for sure. So close.
They couldn't get over the top, Spence.
They couldn't do
it. From what I understand and from what I've seen, you know, Malone, he just couldn't come through when it really mattered.
Yeah.
That's going to haunt him. I'm sorry, Malone.
He was on that runaway bus, and he decided to stop.
Yeah, he hit the brakes in his Furious 7. He hits the brakes, and someone drives back and just shoots him in the head. Because you can't ever hit the brakes.
Yeah.
Man,
totally
wow, they get dark fast.
Oh, jeez. Steele, if you want to go dark, favorite rivalry, I don't even know if I should go here, but it's the most impressive sports rivalry of all time as far as I'm concerned. It's Tonya Harding versus Nancy Kerrigan.
Yeah. Did you see that 30 for 30 documentary, Dave, about it?
No, I didn't watch it.
I did. You know, I love female figure skater documentaries, so I'll tell you all about it. No, it was quite good. I learned a lot about the whole rivalry and the kind of assault and all that stuff, but that one was pretty dark. Paying your boyfriend's hiring a hitman or whatever to go literally hit her in the knee, it was savage.
Yeah, that is a little bit much. How can we lighten this up right now? I feel like we need some type of brightness.
All right, here's my idea. Small talk.
Yes.
Dave, you invented a sport or a game to play with small talk. What are the parameters?
Okay, so let me tell you about the origin of this game. We used
the what
to
of
live...
this game?
The origin. The origin.
The origin.
Yes.
Okay.
We used to live near... actually, we lived right above a nice Hungarian family, and I didn't really know this was a thing, but I think it's confirmed now that Hungarians love to talk, and they'll trap you. They're super friendly, but they just have so much they want to say that you don't have an opportunity to say anything. You just have to kind of smile and nod. So they invited me and my wife over for dinner, and beforehand I had to come up with a strategy of how to survive this dinner other than just smiling and nodding. So we came up with small talk, the sport.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hungarians are the mother of necessity or whatever, mother of invention.
Yes, Hungarians, most progress we've made in the last 100 years has been because of Hungarians in some way or another.
So what's the sport? What are the rules?
So, and you can tailor it a little bit to yourself, but usually there's two of you. You're going into some type of social situation. Might be uncomfortable, might be Hungarian dominated, doesn't have to be. But you each have three topics of conversation you're assigned to bring up. And these topics can be anything. Like, you can take them from our small talk ideas, and you assign your different people, your spouse, like, you have to talk about umbrellas, pooping on the toilet, and one other thing. And the first person to get all three out in the conversation wins the round. They win.
Okay, so is it the honor system? Or do you have to have a witness confirm that you indeed talked about umbrellas?
It works best if both of you are in the same conversation. So there's like four people, and it's kind of you versus your spouse versus the other people, because it works best with you're having to fight your way into the conversation. But it could work in any situation.
And so each of you are assigned three different topics?
Yes.
And you're able to assign your partner or your competitor, there are three topics.
And you have to do it with still like an air of sportsmanship. You don't want to assign them something, again, inappropriate or that would be offensive. But yeah, you assign it to them. And I still remember I won the first game, but my wife still contests it because I think one of my topics was umbrellas. And rather than let it be natural in any way whatsoever, I was like, hey guys, what about umbrellas, huh? And she felt like that was kind of forcing it a little bit.
Mm. So, yeah, I mean, this sounds like a sport that could catch on.
Next time I see you, Steele, let's just do this and see what we can do.
Let's go find some Hungarians. Get some goulash and play small talk the sport.
Hungarians love cucumbers. That's what I gained from that dinner. And they're delicious. I understand.
Cukes.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's been any Hungarians in the NBA. There could be some all-time great names when that happens. Like, there was a soccer player whose name was Balázs Gyurcsák. He was Hungarian.
I bet he was a talker. It's universal. Hungarians love to talk.
Hey, well, the next thing we're going to talk about, we're going to wrap up this episode with two regular segments. The first thing is Unchained Melodies, and this is the sports edition. So we're going to play songs that have some connection to sports. Anybody want to start us off?
I'll start it off. Because I actually attended a show last week. Belle and Sebastian came through. And one of the songs they played was Piazza, New York Catcher. Although Stuart, the lead singer, had a cold. And Piazza, New York Catcher has some pretty high notes. So he actually asked the audience to help him. He got a couple of volunteers, and he'd run over to them when it got to notes that were too high for him to sing. And they would try to help him out.
So was it you and your wife that were singing?
No, he did. He passed over me, mostly because we were in the balcony. Otherwise, I'm sure he would have chosen me. But
like, I'm looking for a prepubescent 32-year-old. Do we have any in the audience?
Yeah. Can I get somebody whose voice is going to crack in the middle of the song?
San Francisco's calling us. The Giants and Mets will play. Piazza, New York, catcher, are you straight or are you gay? We hung about the stadium, we got no place to stay. We hung about the tenderloin, and tenderly you tell about the saddest book you ever read. It always makes you cry, the statue's crying too, and Willie May. I love you, I've a drowning grip on your adoring face. I love you, my responsibility has found a place.
Yeah, that's a great song.
It's adorable. I love Belle and Sebastian. I saw them a few months ago when they came here, but it couldn't possibly have been as adorable as Spence, you and Emmeline watching them. That just warms my heart.
Speaking of heartwarming, Dave, I've got a song. This is a song that warms my heart every time I hear it. This is Public Enemy. The song is He Got Game, and the reason why it's such a great song is because Chuck D is a genius. And also, it's because they took that really memorable line from the guitar riff from the Buffalo Springfield song. So So every time you hear this, it's like that classic Vietnam track with awesome, awesome rapping over it. So this is Public Enemy, He Got Game.
Yeah, that's right. This cut goes out to all y'all that's been missing us for mad years. One love, yo. Yeah, that's right. He's got game. PE 1998.
If man is the father, the sun is the center of the earth, in the middle of the universe, then why is this verse coming 6 times rehearsed? Don't freestyle much, but I write them like such.
Word.
Amongst the fiends controlled by the screens, what does it all mean, all this shit I'm seeing? Human beings screaming vocal javelin, sign of a local nigga unraveling.
Uh-huh.
My wandering got my ass wondering, where Christ is in all this crisis? Hating Satan never knew what nice is. Check the papers, well I bet on ISIS. More than your eye can see and ears can hear. Year by year, all the sense disappears. Nonsense perseveres, prayers links with fear. Beware, 2 triple O.
It might feel good, it might sound a little something, but damn the game, if it don't mean nothing. What is game? Who got game? Where's the game in life? Behind the game, I got game, she got game, we got game, they got game, he got game. It might feel good, it might sound little...
Flavor Flav is the greatest hype man ever. Great, great sports song. Dave, what do you got for us?
I wanted to match Spence's tone as, you know, kind of really super wienery music that I really like. And so, of course, I brought Simon and Garfunkel, The Boxer. Probably their toughest, manliest song of all time. And that doesn't say much.
I am just a poor boy, though my story is seldom told. I have squandered my resistance for a pocket full of mumbles, such are promises. All lies and jest, still the man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest. When I left my home and my family, I was no more than a boy in the company of strangers, in the quiet of the railway station, running scared. Laying low, seeking out the poor quarters where the ragged people go, looking for the places only they would know. Bye-la-lai,
I love that song. I think what we used to listen to was the live Central Park show they did in the 80s. We'd listen to that version the most. It had a little bit more kick to it, and I just loved it. Yeah, I thought it was tough at the time, and now I just think it's beautiful. I think it's a really, really beautiful song.
Yeah, that reminds me of the time, Dave, that you and I dressed up as Simon and Garfunkel for Halloween.
Yeah, we looked great. It was pretty much picture perfect.
Yeah.
Wow. All right, Spencer, you got another song for us?
Yeah, we could give Skilo a listen.
Oh,
I
man,
remember
this is a
classic. My brother, when I was younger, he was in high school, and he started listening to Skilo. I look back on that, and that he's an awful rapper. It's a terrible song, but, you know, that was part of my childhood.
You're really selling it, Spence.
Hello? I wish I was a little bit taller. I wish I was a baller. I wish I had a girl who looked good, I would call her. Wish I had a rabbit in a hat with a bat and a 6-4 fall. I wish I was like 6'9" so I could get with Leo. She, cause she don't know me, but yo, she's really fine. You know, I see her all the time, everywhere I go. And even in my dreams, I can scheme a way to make her mine. Cause I know she's living fat. Her boyfriend's tall and he plays ball. So how am I gonna compete with that? Cause when it comes to playing basketball, I'm always last to be picked, and in some cases never pick it off. So I just lean up on the wall or sit up in the bleachers with the rest of the girls who came to watch their man ball. Dad, y'all, I never understood black. While the jocks get the fly girls, and me, I get the hood rats. I tell them scat, skittles, the Bible. Got hit with a body.
He wishes he was like 6'9".
Yeah, is it established how tall Skilo is?
A good, great question.
That's one for the ages. I have no idea how tall he is, but I mean, I feel sympathy with him. I've wanted to be taller in my past.
Hey, his real name I just found is Antoine Roundtree.
Why not just go with that as your rap name? That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Just go with Roundtree. That's pretty tough.
What if he had played with Clarence Weatherspoon? That would have been a team for the ages.
We could still get them together, at least in some kind of performance.
Yeah, charity game.
Should we do any more?
Yeah, Dave, you got another one?
Yeah, I feel like I got to do it. Camper Van Beethoven, Take the Skinheads Bowling. I don't know what this song means, but at some point during the song, everyone goes bowling. That's a sport, and this song is just, it's terrific.
Every day I get up and pray to John, and he increases the number of clocks by exactly one. Everybody's coming home for lunch these days. Last night there were skinheads on my lawn. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Some people say that bowling alley's got big lanes.
Got big lanes, got big lanes.
Some people say that bowling alleys all look the same. There's not a line that goes here that rhymes with anything.
And I agree. And if there's skinheads on your lawn, the best move is to get them off the lawn by offering them a nice game of bowling.
That's a great song, Dave. So I was really torn in a couple of directions on this one. I didn't know what I should play. But I think that I'm going to go with a weird, awesome song. This is by a group called the Duckworth Lewis Method, and they record an album that's all about cricket. It's called Sticky Wickets. The song is called Nudging and Nerdling.
Nudging and Nerdling.
Nudging and Nerdling.
Nudging and nerdling. Nudging and nerdling.
Nudging and nerdling.
There's like 5 minutes of that. Just people saying nudging and nerdling in English accents.
I mean, it made me feel a little uncomfortable, but great job, Duckworth Lewis Method.
Yeah. So that's our Unchained Melodies Sports Edition. Hope you enjoyed it. Well, this episode is about to come to a close. The thing that we're going to do as a closing is to play a little bit of book wisdom for you. This is from a great book by a Uruguayan author named Eduardo Galeano. The book is called Soccer in Sun and Shadow. And this is a little short chapter called The Goalkeeper. They also call him doorman, keeper, goalie, bouncer, or netminder. But he could just as well be called martyr, pay all, penitent, or punching bag. They say where he walks, the grass never grows. He is alone, condemned to watch the match from afar. Never leaving the goal, his only company, the two posts and the crossbar, he awaits his own execution by firing squad. He used to dress in black, like the referee. Now the referee doesn't have to dress like a crow, and the goalkeeper can console himself in his solitude with colorful gear. He does not score goals. He is there to keep them from being scored. The goal is soccer's fiesta. The striker sparks delight, and the goalkeeper, a wet blanket, snuffs it out. He wears the number one on his back. The first to be paid? No. The first to pay. It is always the keeper's fault, and when it isn't, he still gets blamed. Whenever a player commits a foul, the keeper is the one who gets punished. They abandon him in the immensity of the empty net to face his executioner alone. And when the team has a bad afternoon, he is the one who pays the bill, expiating the sins of others under a rain of flying balls. The rest of the players can blow it once in a while, or often, and then redeem themselves with a spectacular dribble, a masterful pass, a well-placed volley. Not him. The crowd never forgives the goalkeeper. Was he drawn out by a fake? Left looking ridiculous? Did the ball skid? Did his fingers of steel turn to putty? With a single slip-up, the goalie can ruin a match. or lose a championship, and the fans suddenly forget all his feats and condemn him to eternal disgrace. Damnation will follow him to the end of his days.
I don't want to be a goalkeeper. That's convinced me. I'm out.
Off the chain. It's off the chain.
Got a great cover image of like a nude guy hurdling a cricket wicket. A cricket wicket. Is that right? Cricket wicket?
Sure. Good enough.
Okay.